This is The Case of Fear, written by John Plain and read by Tom Weiss. Chapter 1. Changes at Spindrift. The sounds of hammer and saw had disturbed Spindrift Island for several days, and Rick Brandt was having a hard time getting used to it. The noise didn't bother him. It was the idea behind the noise. The idea that the close fellowship of the famous island was about to be intruded upon by strangers. He sat in a comfortable chair on the front porch of the big Brandt house and stared morosely at the Atlantic. He was a tall, athletic boy with brown hair and eyes, and a face that was usually pleasant. "What's it going to be like with a mob of strangers galloping all over the place?" he demanded. Don Scott grinned lazily from the depths of his armchair. He was a husky youth, perhaps an inch taller than Rick, with black hair and dark eyes. "Since when do five people make a mob?" he inquired. "Besides, I think adding more scientists to the staff is a good thing. So does Dad."
"I know it," Rick returned gloomily. "The others do, too. I'm a downtrodden minority. No one sympathizes with me."
Scotty shook his head sadly. "Poor old Rick. Seriously, I don't get it. You should be cheering the loudest. Think of what it means, pal. More fields of science to explore, including one I never heard of before. Maybe more expeditions of different kinds than the ones we've been on up to now."
"That's what I've been thinking about," Rick returned.
"Then why all the gloom?"
"Because," Rick stopped as the phone rang in the house.
Scotty got to his feet quickly. "I'll get it. Mom and Dad are down watching the builders." Rick smiled as Scotty went into the house. It pleased him to have Scotty call Mr. and Mrs. Brandt Mom and Dad. It was a symbol of Scotty's permanence in the family. No one had ever questioned Scotty's membership in the Spindrift tribe since the day when a scrappy ex-Marine had rescued Rick from a gang of thugs bent on destroying the Island Foundation's moon rocket. And it was pleasant to think of Scotty as a permanent brother. The two of them had been through some tight places together, and they were closer friends than brothers usually are. Like Rick, Scotty was listed on the membership rolls of the Spindrift Foundation as a junior technician. Hartson W. Brandt was listed as president, but it was Rick's pride that he and Scotty had earned places because of their own worth and not because of their relationship with the scientists. However, their abilities were not the same. Because of Rick's interest in science, particularly electronics, he had become expert in intricate wiring, and he was rapidly learning about the design of equipment. Scotty's talent was in the mechanical field. He could repair machinery, and he was a whiz with engines. Thinking about work in the lab reminded Rick that he had an unfinished project of his own on his workbench upstairs. He was half out of his chair, determined to go upstairs and put the rest of the afternoon to good use, when Scotty called, "Rick, hurry up." He ran into the library and found Scotty holding the phone. "Here's a funny one, Rick. The Whiteside Telegraph office has a cable for you, but they won't read it over the phone because it's all numbers, and it's from Chada." Chada, the Hindu boy who had been like a member of the family since he joined a Spindrift expedition in Bombay, was back home in India. He had left the boys in New Caledonia after a recent adventure in order to visit his family. "I better talk to them," Rick said. "Who's on the wire?"
"Bill Martin."
Rick took the phone. "Bill, this is Rick. What's up?"
"Got a cable addressed to you," Bill answered. "I'd rather not try to read it over the phone because it's all numbers. Can you or Scotty pick it up?"
"Where's it from?" Rick asked.
"Singapore, and it's signed by your Indian friend."
"Singapore? What on earth was Chada doing in Singapore?"
Rick couldn't guess.
"Bill, what kind of numbers are they?"
"Groups. Seven figures in each group. If you ask me, it's some kind of code."
Rick thought quickly.
Barbies in Whiteside, Bill. She went over to a movie right after lunch, and she should just about be getting out. You can get her next door at the sugar shop because she always stops in there for a fudge sundae after the show. If she's already gone, phone the boat landing. You ought to catch her one place or the other.
I'll try, Bill promised. If I don't catch her, I'll call you back.
Thanks a million. Rick restored the phone to its cradle and looked at Scotty.
What do you make of that?
Scotty shrugged.
Beats me. I didn't know Chata was planning to leave Bombay.
If it comes to that, I didn't know he knew anything about coats.
Neither did I, Rick agreed. Remember he said something about a job in his last letter? There was something secret about it he couldn't tell us. Maybe that's why he's in Singapore.
Could be. Anyway, we won't know for sure until we get the cable and decipher it.
If we can decipher it, that is.
We'll be able to, Rick said confidently. He wouldn't send us one we couldn't break.
Scotty nodded. I hope you're right. Well, let's go back and get lazy again.
Not me. Rick started for the stairs. I'm going to stop loafing and get busy. The lenses for the camera arrived a week ago, and I haven't even looked at them.
I'll go with you. I've got some questions about these new people maybe you can answer.
Upstairs in Rick's bedroom, Scotty sat down in the old leather armchair while Rick opened up the doors that concealed his workbench. On the bench was a camera with an odd-looking searchlight and telescope attached. The searchlight gave off invisible infrared rays instead of ordinary light, and the telescope was equipped with special lenses in order to pick up the infrared. When the camera was loaded with special film, it could take pictures in total darkness, provided the subject was within range of the infrared light rays. The camera had played a major part in solving the mystery of Smuggler's Reef. With the evidence collected from Rick's pictures, the police had broken up a ring of gun runners. But Rick still was not satisfied with the camera. He was always striving to find the simplest way of doing a thing. This time he was planning to eliminate both the spring-driven dynamo that powered the searchlight and the infrared telescope. A new type battery in a small metal case already had been mounted under the camera, far enough to one side so it wouldn't interfere with a tripod mount. The battery would give 10 hours of service, and it could be replaced in a moment with a spare carried in the pocket. To take the place of the telescope, Rick had ordered lenses made of the special glass that could see infrared. He intended to put the lenses in ordinary sunglass frames, restore the regular viewfinder to the camera, and turn the telescope over to Scotty. By using the eyeglasses with special lenses, he could see whatever the infrared searchlight was lighting up without the need of looking through the special telescope. Using the glasses and searchlight on the camera together, he could see perfectly in the darkness, and he could take movies too, if he wanted. He went to work removing the telescope.
I've checked, Scotty said. That scope will fit the mount on my rifle with no changes.
Scotty already had a telescopic sight on his rifle, and a telescope from the infrared unit could be put in its place with a simple turn of a screw. The infrared scope and light originally had been designed for a rifle to be used by soldiers at night. Rick had simply adapted the unit to his own needs.
We can get in some night skunk hunting, Scotty said. You put the infrared on them and take their pictures, and I'll sight them in through the special scope and shoot them.
Rick slipped the telescope out of its mount and handed it to Scotty.
If there's one thing I don't need, he said, it's a dead skunk.
Couldn't we hunt prairie moose instead?
What's a prairie moose? Scotty demanded.
A field mouse with horns.
Scotty groaned.
All right, scientist. Let's get serious and see if you can answer this one. We have an archaeologist, a naturalist, and a cybernetist coming. I think I know what the first two are, but what in the name of a blue baboon is a cybernetist?
Rick put the camera viewfinder into place and began to adjust it. "A specialist in cybernetics," he said. Scotty waved his arms. "Now I know," he exclaimed triumphantly. "Any idiot knows what cybernetics is or what they are. 10 cents apiece at any hardware counter. No family should be without a handy-dandy cybernetic." Rick chuckled. "All right. Cybernetics is a combined study of machines and the human nervous system. It's trying to figure out how machines and humans are related. I don't know much about it myself, but I do know this. The big electronic calculators that do problems in a few hours that it would take humans hundreds of years to finish were the result of cybernetics." "The big brains," Scotty looked on. "I've read about them. And to think we're going to have that kind of expert here. With his wife and 2 kids, Rick added. I wonder how Huggins will like a crowd of kids trampling through his garden." Scotty laughed outright. "Here we go again. Listen, Rick, start making sense. How can twins less than a year old trample anyone's garden?" Rick didn't try to answer. He finished the adjustment on the camera and put it back on the shelf, then started to work replacing the lenses in an old pair of sunglasses with the ones he had ordered. After a moment, he asked, "Scotty, how would you like it if an expedition left Spindrift and we weren't with it?" Scotty stared. "My sainted aunt, is that what's been bothering you?" Rick admitted it. He knew where he stood with the old gang, Hartz and Brandt, Hobart Zircon, Julius Weiss, and John Gordon. He was far from sure of how the new staff members would look on him and Scotty. He had learned that some scientists had little patience with people who were unfamiliar with their special fields, and he and Scotty were pretty ignorant about the new sciences that would be represented. That was his only reason for objecting when his father had decided to enlarge the staff. "I can see it now," he said. "The Foundation will be planning an expedition, maybe to be headed by this new naturalist, and we'll be on the outside looking in. And why? Because Dr. Howard Shannon prefers not to be bothered by a couple of kids who wouldn't know one bug from another." "You're crossing bridges before you come to them," Scotty pointed out. "For all you know, all 3 of these new scientists might be perfectly swell gents, like Zircon, Weiss, and Gordon. Why borrow trouble in advance?" "I suppose you're right," Rick had to agree. "But I still can't help thinking about it." "Think all you like," Scotty said generously. "Me? I'm going to put my little gray brain cells to work on Chata's cable. Aren't you all fired up with curiosity?" Rick started to say he was, but no reply was necessary because just then he heard the sound of the motorboat engine for which his ears had been attuned. He put down the sunglasses and ran for the door. Scotty had heard the engine, too, and was halfway down the hall. It had to be Barbie, Rick was sure. The other motorboat, the Island had, too, was tied up at the pier, and they weren't expecting any visitors. The builders had their own boat, a powered barge, anchored off Pirates Field. The boys ran out on the front porch and around the house, then down the long flight of stairs that led to the cove where the motorboat landing was located. It was Barbie, sure enough, and she had the cable. She waved it wildly, then gunned the boat around neatly so that it slid into the dock. Scotty grabbed the bow line and made fast, while Rick jumped for the stern line and slipped it around a cleat on the landing. Barbie cut the engine and jumped to the dock, a slim, pretty girl, her face flushed with excitement. "It's from Chata," she said breathlessly, "and it's in code." "We know," Scotty said. "Here, let's take a look at it." Barbie handed it to him. He scanned it wordlessly, then handed it to Rick. "Son, we'll be doing right well if we make any sense out of that." "He wouldn't send us anything in a code that we couldn't read," Rick objected. "Let's see it. It can't be too hard." But in the next moment, he changed his mind. His lips pursed in a low whistle. The cable was addressed to Rick Brandt, Spindrift Island,
New Jersey, USA, and was a table of numbers 6 columns wide and 6 rows deep. It was signed El Chata.